accession number 19049, reel 5.
Malcolm Connolly, reel 5. We came down off the Tidham Road, down into the valley once again, and we came down this side of the Chinwin River. And the Chinwin River, I'm not quite sure whether the place was Kalaimyo or Kalewa, but one is on one side of the Chinwin River and the other is on the other side. I think it's Kalewa on the Indian side and Kalaimyo on the Burmese side. I'm not quite sure. But we came down there, and there was nobody about, and we was met by representatives of the regiment who were then encamped in the valley itself, in the Kabor Valley. They'd come down through the Kabor Valley. We come over the Chin Hills, and they came down through the Kabor Valley, and they were encamped. And that's where they stayed until they were ordered to cross the Chinwin. In that time, they built a Bailey Bridge, which was the longest span Bailey Bridge ever built in Second World War. And but it wasn't, as it was a single span, it wasn't strong enough to take our tanks. So we were actually floated from a point upstream to a point downstream. I forget exactly where. It wasn't far from where the regiments who had retreated out of Burma, Svejing, not far from there, because some of the wrecks of the 7th Hussars and second tanks, Stuarts were still floating about there, or burned out or destroyed. And it was there that I rejoined the regiment, only to be told that I was entitled to a month's war leave, and I was make my way to Calcutta, and so I disappeared to Calcutta for a month.
Which month was that?
That was January 1945. I had Christmas 1944 in Calcutta, on the race course in Calcutta, and because they flew us out. And I had the month of January on leave in Calcutta. And to be quite truthful, there was nothing. There was nothing at all. We could go to theatre shows and things like that, and we could get drink and all the rest that goes with that sort of place. But there wasn't a lot of... There was nobody to entertain us or to... the race course, which was a big holiday camp. Holiday camp, absolutely nothing at all. You just they fed and watered you, there was a bed for you, but nothing else. And so in actual fact, I wasn't sorry to return back to the unit, who then had crossed the Chinwin River and were down on the way to Mandalay, Papa Cuckoo. They and to be quite truthful, we had been The regiment itself had been so sadly hit with tanks. They'd lost so many tanks that they couldn't be replaced because of the line of communication, that they found it easier to bring a whole new regiment, which was the Gordon Harlanders 116 Royal Armour Corps, who were who trained in the Kabor Valley in various places and were first used at the Battle for Megtilla. But they used us all the way down through Mandalay, through Papa Cuckoo, Mandalay, Svejing, and my squadron. We participated in it right up to the very end, virtually. But we were sent back after we left Mandalay, down past the place, the big oil centre of Yeninyum, which was virtually destroyed. We participated in the retaking of Yeninyum, and we participated in the Mount Popper. Now, Mount Popper was a very interesting place because it really was an extinct volcano, and it was known as the home of the King Cobra. because all the lava, it had been extinct for many, many years, but all in the lava, the cobra bred. And so the infantry, which was a part of the 2nd British, they were the last part of the 2nd British Division still left. I think it was 6th Brigade, I'm not quite sure about that, but they were the last brigade. All the others had been flown back to India, and 6th Brigade, with us in support, had been given the job of taking Mount Popper plus Yuen and Yung. And then they were sent back to India. And so there was no complete, apart from the Carbineers, there was no complete British units left in India. All the units were Indian. There was one or two infantry battalions in the Indian divisions, but most of the British division, the 2nd British Division, was flown out. They were time expired. They were worn out anyway. And the same as my regiment. We were worn out. We'd been virtually in action right from March of 1944 right up to August, September of 1945. And when we, they then wanted a little bit more blood, and so we crossed the Irrawaddy at a place called Magwi to Mimbu, or the other way about, Mimbu to Magwi. I'm not quite sure which is which, but one is on one side of the Irrawaddy, and we crossed there with an Indian division, 5 Indian, I think it was. And the territory was so bad. It was all hilly, and the Japs were retreating down that part from the Arakan. And our job was to cut them off and stop their retreat. We had so few tanks left. We had many crews, but no tanks. And the last action of the Carbineers was, at least, of C Squadron Carbineers, was that the division was held up by this particular gun somewhere. I'm not quite sure the name of the place now. But anyway, we was held up there, and they said the tanks could take that out. Anyway, they'd lost 2 or 3 tanks in the previous days. But this tank went up to engage this gun, and the gun opened up, hit the tank, and the tank went up with the loss of 7. And when the infantry actually overrun the gun, it was a British 25-pounder, which, of course, we didn't have a hope in hell against. It was the finest tank buster in the world. No, and, of course, the Japs had had a lot of these things. They'd taken them on the retreat out of Burma. And it was then decided that we'd outstayed our welcome. And so we was ordered to cross back across the Irrawaddy and to go down to a place called Prome, where we would dismantle our tanks, the few that was left. I think there was 4... there was 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and HQ 5, that's 16, 20 tanks per squadron. So out of the 20, we had 4, maybe 5 tanks left out of the squadron. And the guns in the tanks that we had been used so much that the rifling inside the 7.5 and 3.7 was non-existent, which made the tank, any gunner will tell you that if a gun has no rifling, it's more dangerous to the people firing it than it is those being fired at. Anyway, we went to Prome, and we dismantled our tanks, we took the engines out, took the guns out, dismantled the tracks, and just left the hulks. And then we moved on then. We were then taken to Shan Road, Rangoon, where we was given a house to live in. And these were big houses that the gentry of Rangoon had lived. And one memory I have of that house was that it was raining, the monsoons were in full force, and anything with slant eyes you viewed with suspicion, because there were so many people that looked very, very similar. The Assamese, the Gurkha, the Burmese, they all have got slitty eyes. and they all looked very, very much alike. And so anybody that had slitty eyes, you viewed with suspicion. And I remember that this Burmese lady used to come in into the garden, and because it was all overgrown, had been a lovely place in its time. Typical Burmese house made of attab, and we'd actually pulled the fronts out so all the air could circulate through, but they had smaller windows. And I said to this woman, I said, "What are you doing in here?" And she replied to me in perfect English. She said, "I could ask you the same. What are you doing here?" I said, "Well, I said, I'm here because I've got to be here." I said, "But what are you doing here?" She said, "You are living in my house." She said, "This is my house," she said. "And what and when will you be leaving?" I said, that's not up to me. I said, I couldn't tell you who decides whether when we are going and when we are staying or what's going to happen to us. I said, we don't need to be told. She said, first, she said, we have the British. She said, then we have the Japanese. Now we've got the British again. She said, I don't know who's the best out of the lot of them. And with that, she went off. I never saw her no more. And we participated in the big victory parade in Rangoon. And I'm not quite sure about the date, but I remember the ship, which was His Majesty's Indian ship, the Llansteffan Castle. And the regiment was boarded. We went on board, took our dog with us, took Jif with us, and we eventually finished up in Madras. We crossed the Bay of Bengal down to Madras, where we were put into a transit camp for a very short period of time. And in that time, the dog disappeared. There was absolute pandemonium. The major, who in our travels down had received a very serious injury to his legs, had been in hospital right from the early months of 1945. He returned back to look for the dog. And we had Indian police all out looking for the dog. But the dog was never found. It disappeared. And soldiers' humour. Some said he should have come back through his Burma Star. And the other said that he'd met a girl who would listen to his war stories. But we never found Jif anymore. And he disappeared in the city of Madras, which, of course, is a teeming multitude of people. And from there, we went to a place called Ahmednagar, where we were told we were going to participate in Operation Zipper, which was the landings on Malaya and Singapore. But fortunately, they dropped the atom bombs. And though the operation went, Operation Zipper actually took place, the force actually went, they left us behind because we were big tanks and we were more trouble than what we were worth. And then we were posted up to, within all in a very short period of time, we were posted up to a place called Rawalpindi. And I thought, what the hell did they send us up there for? But it came out at a later date that they put tanks up there to deter the Russians, because nobody thought they could use tanks in that mountainous warfare. And the Carbineers have proved beyond any shadow of a doubt that tanks can be used anywhere if properly used and properly handled. And I arrived up there, and virtually on the same day as I arrived in Rawalpindi, I was warned and said, "Pack your kit, you're for the United Kingdom, your time expired." And so I retraced my footsteps all the way back down to Bombay and returned home to the United Kingdom.
How do you feel now about having served in the Second World War in the Burma campaign with the armour?
Oh, if I had to do it again, I think I'd still like to fight a tank. But altogether, when you look back of the death and the destruction on all sides, the Japanese, the Indians, the Brits, what did it really achieve? It didn't achieve very much. We retook Burma. The Burmans didn't want us there, not really. Mainly through our own sheer incompetence and the way they treated colonial people. But altogether, let's face it, the soldier at the end of the day accomplishes nothing. He kills and destroys. And that's not what life is about. There's far better things in life than killing and destroying. And when you think, and I never bothered to think about it, because to be quite true, as a young man, if I was ordered to do a thing, I didn't argue the task, I did it. Whether I thought it was right or wrong, I was a soldier, and a soldier's job is to obey. And we did things as young men that we really shouldn't have done. But that's what we were told to do, and that's what we did. But altogether, when you weigh it all up, it's all very nice. My badge is on the wall, my mention dispatches and so forth. Waste of time.
You said about the retaking of two places that you gave the names of. One which is familiar to me, Yananyong, the oil refinery place.
Oil refinery, yeah.
And another place I'm not so familiar with called Macpapa. Can you tell me what it was like retaking those?
For tank forces, nothing extra special. We were sitting inside an armoured vehicle. It was the infantry lads outside who had actually bound their legs with the brown paper because of the snakes that could pop out and bite you, I suppose. The cobra, I think, is one of the world's most deadliest of snakes. But I know that the infantry lads and us as well, that as we advanced over this rather broken, craggy, molten, lavaed land, the Japanese were actually down inside the extinct volcano, which was a multitude of tunnels and caves. And I think that we, though we'd overrun it, we never actually drove them out of it. And eventually I was led to believe that they actually put Gurkhas down there inside the volcano, and they sorted them out. But I can't remember, there was outbursts of machine gun fire and things like that. But altogether, I don't think the operation was very, very serious at all, not really, because the Japanese were beaten anyway. They were starving, they were in retreat, and to be quite truthful, in that part, they were just target practice. You would shoot them willy-nilly. And to be quite truthful, they came down with their nurses and their comfort girls and all the rest of it. And to be quite truthful, we just, anything that moved looked like a Jap, you killed it. You didn't give them a chance. There was no chance of them putting their hands up. They weren't people like that. And even though they had to go get past us to cross the Satong River, which of course was the scene of the British disaster, when 17th Indian were left behind on the other side, on the Indochina side of the Satong. And it seemed to be right that they got punished there the same as they punished our fellows on the retreat out, because they did some very dastardly things there. And there was no compassion between Brit, Indian, or Jap. If you saw him, you killed him. You didn't look at him and hope he put his hands up, because if he did, you didn't trust him anyway. And the vast numbers of young Japanese that were killed in that last stages was terrific, horrific. And I don't think as much, apart from the fact that they destroyed one of our tanks with seven young men in it, I can't remember that. Certainly the infantry weren't losing very many chappies at all. They were just target practice. You just killed them, the same as you would do if you went to a fun fair and shot at targets. That's all they were. But they wouldn't give up. There's only one way, and that was to kill them. I mean, they talk about the Second War. They talk about the German army that marched into captivity in Stalingrad. But we killed more than what they took into as prisoners. We actually killed them. Out of the vast numbers of the Japanese armies that marched against us, two-thirds of them were killed. And there was dead bodies everywhere. Because even if he was dead, you didn't trust him. If you saw him laying there, you went over him. Because you knew full well that he'd kill you if he had the opportunity. And it was just, it's a great shame that men have to be trained in that way. I think the highest honour they can get is to commit carry for their emperor. It's utter stupidity. I mean, in the British Army, if you did half the things that the Japs were reported to do, they'd have got a VC. But they wouldn't have been asked by their nation to commit hari kari. But the Japanese did just that. You had to kill them because that's what they wanted. They wouldn't give up. A few of them did. The fewer the better educated ones, I believe. The Carbineers, to the best of my knowledge, only ever took one prisoner. And he was taken because as we were part of the Indian Army, we were entitled to what they called camp followers. Because the Carbineers were actually part of the 254 Indian Tank Brigade. It was part of the Indian Army. And because we were part of the Indian Army, we were entitled to the camp followers that went with the camp, such as Dobie men, cooks, Babajis, all those sort of people. And we took some Indians. I think there was three or five that were attached to my squadron. And the cooks that we had, the Babajis we had, were Indians. They come under the control of a Carbineer, because the ACC didn't come into being until 1943-44. And our Sergeant Cook was a Carbineer. He was eventually replaced by a sergeant of the ACC. But he only administered. He didn't cook. The cooks, the Babajis, were Indians. And the people who did all the menials, that fetched the water and washed the dishes, were Indians. And Sadik, always remember Sadik, because Sadik was an older man than most. And he'd been a camp follower to the Brits ever since he could remember. Because they used to be replaced. As one regiment went, they would take over the camp followers from another regiment. And this chap had been, he'd been camp followers to the British Army ever since he could remember. And we were under strict instructions, a punishable offence to be caught doing the necessary functions of life by digging a hole and in the jungle. They used to, the Carbineers were very strict everywhere they went. Where possible, not always possible, they would dig a trench and put a pole across it. And this is one of the memories I have of that part of the world, is the fact that as you sat there on your pole, you looked down, and of course there was all these men excreting into this hole, and it would be one mass of insects, white lizard types of things, and every so often somebody went along with some petrol, poured it into the urinal or the toilet, and dropped a match in it and burned them. And you were under very severe punishment if you were caught going anywhere else to do that. And, of course, the Indians, they were a different kettle of fish. And Sadik went out to relieve himself in the jungle. And when he got to where he was doing his business, there was a Jap. And the Indian and the Jap spoke together. And how or why, I don't know. But this is an actual, honest fact. You can actually trace it in regimental history. That the Jap gave himself up to the camp follower. And he was taken prisoner. But Why he gave himself up, I don't know. Or whatever happened to him, I don't know. But the only prisoner taken by the carbineers was taken not by a carbineer, but taken by a camp follower who was attached to us, who was part of us. So you can say even right up to the very end, the Jap didn't give himself up, and you didn't trust them, and that there was no compassion, no compassion on our side. And one thing I always remember is the fact that when I used to watch the infantry lads go up, Indian and British, when they advanced up, if they come across the Jap laying there, virtually everyone that passed him stuck a bayonet into him. They didn't look at him, see if he was injured. And the tanks coming up behind would roll over him just to make sure, because you never know, if he got up and he was capable, he'd take somebody with him. So they never got the opportunity. Burma, in my opinion, for what I know about it and my part in it, was completely without compassion, no compassion whatsoever.
What was Sadek like?
Sadek, oh, he's just a typical little Indian man, uneducated, got a job. They wore jungle greens. They wore jungle greens, exactly the same as we did. And where it was possible, because most of the time our cookhouses was a 3-ton lorry, and you queued up and you took your mess tin, so forth and so on. And after you'd sat down anywhere, not always possible, where possible, you sat down anywhere around the cookhouse truck and you ate your rations. When you finished, Sadek would be there with a table with a bucket of water, and he'd wash your things up, wash your utensils up. And he was a typical, I don't know what part of the country he came from, but certainly he was completely uneducated, which most of the Indians were that we had. The LAD units that we had, they were a different kettle of fish. They were most.
These are light aid detachments.
The light aid detachment, yeah, they were Rimi, or the Indian equivalent. And to be quite truthful, I remember being shelled on the Chittum Road, and I jumped into a slit trench, and there was nobody else in there except an Indian. And he was terrified, absolutely terrified. I wasn't feeling sprayed myself, but he was terrified. And when it was all over, I said to him, because the Indian Army, every Indian that participated with the British in India and in many other parts of the world as well, were all volunteers. No conscription in India. They, I believe, if the truth is known, they were the biggest volunteer army of Second World War. And I said to this Indian, who could speak perfect English, and I don't know what trade he was in Rimi, he must have been somebody quite good because he was attached to us. And I said to him, I said, what are you doing here? I said, you have no necessity to be here. He said, Saab, and Indians in those days always addressed British other ranks as Saab. They never called you Johnny, or they never got familiar. You were Saab, sir. And most of them stood to attention to you. And he said, Saab, he said, my father told me, he said, you share my house. He said, and my father tells me, he said, it's only right that if I share, you share my house, that it's only right in time of trouble, he said, I help you. He said, but when this is all over, he said, we are going to kick your butts out of India. And with that, he went. He drank my tea, though. He drank my jar. But and that was the attitude. Now, a lot of them, let's face it, in India in those days, the standard of life was...